Scott from Predator to give us an introduction.
Okay, well, thanks. So this talk is a lesson to you all about not working on Sunday nights. Because I was working late on Sunday night, and the guy I was working with came in my office and said, hey, why don't you give the introduction to particle physics on Monday? And he's standing there, so it's harder to say no if it's, you know. Email, it's easier to say no. Make up some excuse. Think hard. Come up with something. And so I don't know if I took the right approach. So it's a kind of a hard talk to prepare because you're all theorists and you're all pretty smart. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. So who needs an introduction to particle physics? Once you do something for a while, you just assume everyone just knows all this stuff, right? But I'm kind of aiming a little low in the talk at the start, and I'm kind of scaling it up throughout the talk to get you kind of to what's going on now. And that's the approach I took. So first, the first thing I did was I made this slide, and I sarcastically just said, Google particle physics, and then thank you and good night, and I would be done. But let me actually try and talk a little bit about it. So the simple outline is just, I'm going to take a broad overview, and that's basically assuming that you probably saw quantum field theory maybe a couple years ago in grad school, and you've forgotten all about it because you did something else. So it's very basic side of the talk, and I hope I don't insult anyone's intelligence. If I do, well, too bad. And then I'll talk about what's going on in particle physics now, at least from my little perspective, and then what's going on in particle physics in the near future. So this particle physics took a blow recently, because sadly, LHC moved from 2 to 3, because they started it, and it effectively blew up. So that's now in the near future. Hopefully it would have been now, but what can you do? And I think it's true, probably true, that either you know everything I'm about to say, or you're not really interested, because you're not interested because you then went to choose a different PhD, right? So it's like a proof almost that you're not interested in what I'm about to say. And if those things aren't true, you're probably jet lagged. So I'm pretty sure everyone in the audience has one of these or some combination of these. So mostly, I'm going to try to amuse you and myself. I try to amuse myself making up the talk. So where are we in particle physics? Now, a lot of these talks start with a picture of LHC, which is the LHC wow moment, which I will get to. But to really appreciate where we are, I think you should stand back and think where we came from in this field, which has been an amazingly productive field, basically in one person's lifetime. So people know, and they've known for a long, long time, that when you smash things together, very interesting things happen. Any two-year-old knows this. I have a three-year-old now. And one of his favorite things is to smash. So everyone knows this. And scientists have inner children that like to smash things together. And so that's part of the reason to do particle physics experiments, but not the only reason. There's very good reasons to do it. And in fact, this Crockroft and Watson guy, these two guys, in 1930 and 1932, they did arguably the first particle accelerator experiment. And they took a large potential difference, and they took a proton, because they're easier to use. And they accelerated it through big 7 meters with this huge potential difference for the time and smashed it into lithium. And what came out were two helium nuclei. So this is pretty easy to understand, right? Four protons in, four neutrons in, four protons out, four neutrons out. It's a piece of cake. This is their picture of their cool 1930s technology here. Things that look suspiciously like Van der Graaff generators. And I'm not sure if it accelerated up here and smashed down here or vice versa, but it's pretty cool. Think about 1930, right? There wasn't much advanced stuff going on, and those guys were doing this. It's pretty cool. And they got up to 800 kilo-electron volts. So arguably, this is the start of particle physics, because we're so data-driven a field, we need particle accelerators to really learn about things. And these are people that were born in 1930. And particle physics is arguably the coolest thing that was born in 1930. But yeah, it's going to be Buffett, probably Eastwood. Connery, maybe not. He's pretty cool. So maybe he should be on the other side, but I'm partisan. So around the same time, Lawrence and Livingston were building something called cyclotron, which is basically the same idea as a particle accelerator, except it just accelerates things in a circle. And Lawrence actually mocked this thing up, apparently very quickly. It was 4.5 inches, which is, you know, not that big. It's like this big or something. And it got to 80,000 electron volts just by accelerating things in a circle and then whipping them out once it got to the end. And Livingston was his grad student who did all the work, and he scaled this thing up. This was January or so in 1931. They were competing with these guys. And by the summer, they scaled it up to 11 inches and got to a mega electron volt. Now think about that. That's pretty cool. They've got up to from 800 kilo electron volts to a mega electron volt. within like a year. So that's one thing about this field, is it advances very rapidly. You get more and more energy in a small space. And here's this quote, this telegram which was sent. Telegram, yeah, 1931. It was sent to Lawrence from Livingston. Lawrence wasn't even there, he's just the advisor, when he reached a mega electron volt. And if you question my statement about the inner child of scientists, look at this. He suggested that I add whoopee, which I think is pretty cool. So you can look on this website if you ever want to learn about this stuff. I stole these pictures from that website. So I'm going slow at the start. I'm going to speed up now. Okay, so one thing about particle physics is, boy, do those guys get a lot of Nobel Prizes. Crockroft and Watson got one. Lawrence got one. And interesting for Pi's philosophy and structure, Lawrence was actually doing a transgressive act when he figured out to do the cyclotron. He was looking in, as obscure as this sounds, a German electrical engineering journal, and he was what was at the time called a physicist or a physical chemist. So this was a transgressive act. It was outside of his field. And this is an example of cross-pollination. He saw an article by actually a Norwegian, Rolf Witterow, and he couldn't read the German, but he could look at the picture, and he's like, aha, that'll work to accelerate things. And if I put it in a circle, it'll work better. So that's where he got his idea that won the Nobel Prize. So this is what we've learned. Grad students do the work. Livingston didn't get a Nobel Prize. Advisors get the Nobel. Very true in particle physics, but there are exceptions. And new energies are reached very, very fast. We got from like 800 kiloelectron volts up to 1 megaelectron volt in a year. And by 1946, they're up to 100 megaelectron volts. So why this obsession with stuffing energy in small areas, doing particle accelerator experiments? Well, there's very good reasons, right? And remember, things slowed down in part because particle physicists were doing other stuff in the late 30s, early 40s. They were doing some evil stuff, actually. And the field rapidly advances, and then what do you get? Well, you get higher and higher energies, and then you start to convert energy into mass, and things get really fun. So if you get a high enough energy photon, you get a photon which can pair a creighton into an electron and a positron. And because of this, you all remember, I hope, from grad school, that no sensible single particle consistent relativistic quantum theory is possible. Because as you just go to higher and higher energies, which is equivalent to taking some particle in a box, you can think of it as, and then compressing the box, adding energy to compress things. As you get to length scales where you're containing a particle which are comparable or less than the quantum wavelength of, say, an electron, you're going to pair create. So it just doesn't make any sense to write down a consistent, you can't write down a consistent single particle relativistic theory. Quantum theory. So this tells you something. The vacuum is a very exciting place, right? The vacuum is a party. It's a physics party, but it's still pretty cool. And the other people in this building are, maybe in my opinion, a little arrogant. They want a theory of everything, right? We just want a theory of nothing. That's all. We would be happy with a theory of nothing that was sensible. We want a theory of the vacuum, right? So it's not just like these particles are there and pair creation's there randomly. I mean, you need to have positrons when you have electrons because you want to build a consistent relativistic quantum theory, and so for causality to be preserved, I hope you remember, that you need positrons, because what they do is they come in the amplitude of space-time. So if you have a commutator of non-commuting observables, you get a contribution to that from the electron, which is problematic because at these space-time separations is non-zero, and the positron comes in exactly to cancel that off, right? That's its mission in life. It's not like we're just adding another particle for fun. It's actually there to preserve causality and to have a consistent theory. And a few theorists already knew about these things. They knew about positrons. They were thinking of them a little differently, but Dirac wrote down the Dirac equation, which has two solutions. One is a positron, one's an electron. And that's a consistent equation that combines relativity and quantum mechanics. All right, so now I'm kind of going to speed up, scale things up. Just hopefully I was reminding you what you learned in probably grad school, maybe 4 years ago. All right, so this thinking is really core particle physics. And I mean this in two senses. So our language is quantum fields, right? We promote things to operator valued functions of space-time, the dynamics of which are purely local. That's the language we use. And the basic of physical concepts, like Lorentz invariance, and the required symmetries get built into the Lagrangian. And that directly dictates the particle content you see. Right, you build the symmetries in that correspond to the particle content you see. It's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. But that's what dictates what you find in your experiments. So we're symmetry addicts in this field. If you talk to particle physicists, pretty soon they'll start to yell at you about groups, right? They'll start yelling about SU3 or SU2 or something. And that's because reality has taught us to be very focused on symmetry. Because it's a way we figure out what to write down, right? We've been smashing stuff together for years, and we have a model that explains everything we see coming out so far. Its Lagrangian in part is given here. So here's the Higgs sector, which I'm going to get to and get into more detail about. You have fermions, which are spin 1/2. This is kind of like the Dirac equation, except for the mass part's missing. I'll get to that. And don't worry about the slash. If you don't do particle physics, you might not remember this sort of notation. But the D is a covariant derivative, because the symmetries are so important to us. And when you have low, sorry?
Oh, see, that's my kind of light now. You can't see this at all?
No.
Can the light sound more? Let me try, because I have a lot of equations. So I don't want to write them all. Can you see it now?
Switch the lights off.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Like my talk needed to be any cooler. Okay, does anyone see that now?
We can't see you.
That's okay. Just listen to the voice, the soothing voice, right? All right, just think of me as a computer or something. So anyways, this derivative, right? So the derivative, because the symmetries are so important to us, and you can do these local gauge local transformations on the field, the symmetry transformations on the field. At different space time points, you can do slightly different ones. And so you have to introduce, of course, something that makes the derivative of two different space time points, which can have two different symmetry rotations going on, make sense. And you introduce a connection in mathematical language, which is just your gauge field. And the quanta of those gauge fields are just the photon, the W, Z, and gluons. So because you introduce the gauge field, you have to write down the field strengths. I hope you remember classically them. And so we have one for the gluon, and then the W and the V. Those are just a different way of writing down the W and Z in the SU2 crush U1 theory. So symmetry is important to us. We write down our Lagrangian. And the classical standard model, it's not classical, but the standard model, our great development, really, is an SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 H3. And the SU3 part is just QCD. It has a scale in it, actually, that comes out, which is about 200 MeV, squiggle 200 MeV. And then the electroweak theory, which describes radioactivity in E&M, which has a scale of 246 GeV. That's less of a squiggle, actually. We know that better. So we're symmetry addicts, so we're interested in the scales of the problem. Why are we interested in that? Because the scales are the mass of the things. And the difference between masses are interesting, except things like decay rates. And these two scales, which are arguably fundamental scales, come in, right? You have this 246 GeV, and that actually sets the scale of the elementary particles through UCAL couplings and Higgs sector, and we'll tell you about that. And then you have lambda QCD, which is setting the scale of hadronic Mach, which I'm not going to really talk too much about, but it's actually quite important as well. We have quite a pattern of masses in the standard model. We've done a lot of experiments for 80 years now, and I put boy, oh boy, and then I realized I was being politically correct, so girls, girls. And we found all these different masses. So we found effectively massless things, neutrinos. There's three of them. There's three generations. That's something that's a puzzle in the standard model. We don't really have a good idea as to why that is. But we have neutrinos for each generation. We have electron, and then it's heavier friend, and then it's obese friend. And we have an up-type quarks and down-type quarks. And we get all the way up to top quarks, which are just found in 94, I think. And they're 175 GeV. And you can just, you know, visually see the difference in masses just because of the size of the red blobs. The Higgs we haven't found yet, which I'll talk about a lot. That's pretty good. We know through indirect means, which I'll talk about, that it's at least greater than 114 GeV and less than 150 GeV. We're pretty sure it's there. And we also have W bosons and Z bosons, which are massive. And this one's 80. This one's 91.2 GeV, both of those. So we have this huge different pattern. We have this huge pattern of masses in the standard model. So we better have a very good explanation for these masses, right? I mean, we spend a lot of money in particle physics. And I said we had two scales, arguably, fundamentally in the theory at the start. We had this electroweak scale, and we had lambda QCD. So we better have a really good explanation as to all that, those two scales give all of these masses, right? Well, we don't actually know, in the capital letter sense of the word know, what's giving masses to things. That's because the theory has predictions, in particular the Higgs boson, which we haven't found yet, right? But we know in the lowercase sense, because we have a really good idea as to where masses are coming from. We actually have a lot of evidence to support it. It's not like we have no evidence at all. We have a heck of a lot of evidence, actually. The consistent pictures really screams at us that there's a Higgs, no matter how much we don't like the idea. And
So where do the masses come from? You can't just write down masses directly in the Lagrangian, because I told you gauge invariants, the symmetries are our whole existence. They tell us what we write down in the Lagrangian. And it violates gauge invariants if you just write down masses directly in the Lagrangian. So to give masses to things, we have a clever trick, which is just spontaneous symmetry breaking in particle physics. And there's lots of Nobel Prizes that were given out for that. Just recently, too. So we give masses to things by taking the Higgs and giving it a vacuum excitation value. By hand, we put in this potential. Right? And that potential looks like this. So the simple idea, in case you don't know your Higgs physics, is that at the early universe, there's actually thermal contributions to the Higgs mass, which are basically a parabola, like T squared, right? So the Higgs field oscillates around zero, its mass. And as the temperature of the universe cools down, eventually it starts to see this underlying potential, which we write in by hand. And it knows then that there's this other vacuum that wants to oscillate around, which is lower down, so it eventually transmits down, falls down to the lower vacuum, oscillates around that, and it gains a vacuum expectation value. It's V, this 246. Right? And then we expand our Higgs field around that lower vacuum. And then once the Higgs gets a vacuum expectation value transmitted through the Yukawa couplings, which are just this part of the Lagrangian, the leptons and the quarks get their masses. They all get their masses from this fundamental scale, 246 GeV. So it all just comes from those Yukawa couplings. This might look a little obscure, but it just was dictated by the symmetries of the theory. You have right and left-handed guys that you couple to the Higgs, which then gets back an excitation value. Well, we say a particular mass, of course, is just the particular Yukawa coupling times this fundamental scale V, and that's the explanation. We have a huge range of masses we found, and so we can explain it just really well. All we need is a huge range of couplings, right? So that's really easy. We've explained a very deep mystery of science. It's not really that deep, but this could deeply offend you, right? Because we've just changed one thing into another thing. Why do we have all those different masses? Well, why do we have all these different couplings? But this is actually what we think is happening, right? Many tests work of this. We're not just telling you this for no reason. What you actually get out of this, for one thing, are not just individual masses. You don't get this directly. It's actually a little bit more complicated story. What you actually get out are mass matrices for the up-type quark and the down-type quarks. And they're not actually initially in their mass eigenstates. So you have to rotate them individually to their mass eigenstates. The up-type quarks and the down-type quarks are rotated differently. And you can actually do that rotation. It's a unitary transformation of the theory to go from what are the weak eigenstates to the mass eigenstates of the theory. And when you do that, you get something called the CKM matrix, which is the combination of the rotations on the up-type sector and the down-type sector quarks. This is a 3x3 unitary matrix, 3 because of 3 generations. So what's going on now in particle physics recently? So I've gotten over the very start of the talk, which I hope didn't insult you, which is this kind of the basic review of the language of the field and quantum field theory. And I'm going to talk more about what's going on in particle physics now, and then I'll get to what's going on in the future. Okay? Are there any questions yet? I've dulled you into sleep, lights put you to sleep. Good. Excellent. It'll be easy then. No one's awake. Okay, good. So this CKM matrix, this 3x3 matrix, is this just familiar to everyone? This is something I wasn't sure. Because I don't want to tell string theorists. We once had a string theorist who came to visit where I was doing my grad work. And he didn't know what the CKM matrix was. So I figured I would kind of explain these things. Does everybody know what the CKM matrix is? No one wants to say? No, not everyone does? Okay. So it's good for me to tell you what it is. All right. So it's a 3x3 matrix, right? And then it should be unitary because all it is changing one set of states of the theory into another set. So you're going from the weak basis, what you get directly out of the Yukawa couplings, to that fundamental scale once the Higgs gets a BEV, to another basis, which is just the mass basis of the theory. So it should be unitary. It's just a unitary transformation on the basis states of the theory. So you can write the unitarity constraint given here. If you take these are individual row and column elements of that 3x3 matrix. And if you take a row and a column, complex conjugated, it should either be 1 or 0, depending on which row and column you took. That's just mathematical expression of unitarity. So one particular row and column combination is just given here. So these are things that have to do with when you have, say, an up-type quark transitioning to a down-type quark and emitting a W or absorbing a W. And up-type quark to B-type quark, so on and so forth. So these are just fundamental things that are in the Lagrangian of the theory. These are fundamental pieces of information. And so a visual representation of three complex numbers added together equaling zero is just a triangle. That's this black triangle here. Right? If you think of these as vectors in a complex plane, they should just add up to zero. So that's what these three things are here. And we've gone and measured the heck out of this thing. Now, what's going on in particle physics up until recently was measuring this in something called flavor physics, and d-physics. And so they use k-mesons to get this constraint on some of these parameters, which is just this green band here. They measured directly this angle through b-meson decays. They did b-meson oscillations, which gave them this, this area here, and then they did another one here. And there's an expert in the audience that had something to do with getting DUB that did that. And all these things combined tell us that this is a consistent picture. This is unitary. This triangle closes. And it works. This thing, as best as we can figure out, is unitary, which is some good information about the flavor sector of the theory and that we actually understand what's going on. If there was new physics coming in that is not built into the standard model, it should screw this up. It could screw this up. That was the hope, right? So, yeah, it could be something else. In fact, people thought this would be a great way to discover new physics. This was actually a very intelligent way, which was slightly less just smash things together. This is kind of subtle stuff, right? Like, there should be a pattern in the data which we should be able to test. And if it's just the standard model, it'll be unitary. But great arguments existed that it should be affected by new physics, and it isn't. At least not to the experimental accuracy of what we figure out. Okay, so this matrix was just a representation of a basis change. It should be unitary, hence the question. It could be anything else, right? But if new physics came in, it should have screwed this up. It's a good test of the standard model. And this thing works, okay? This thing works really well. Costs a lot of money. It's non-trivial information that the CKM picture is consistent with the standard model. Now, this is not really a pure test of the Higgs, but it's hard to make other schemes do this instantly. I mean, now we're very good. We're very smart at doing things. We can now, anyone can build a model that can do this. But it rules out full classes of model that would affect this, right? So it restricts your options. So what else is going on in particle physics now? Oh, wow. I'm going to be quick. Maybe going too quick. Okay, let me slow down a little bit, try explaining this a little more detail. So we haven't seen the Higgs directly, right? That's the one thing we haven't seen directly. We've seen every other quark on that point. But we have seen its footprint in the data. We have seen its footprint so much that we really think it's there, despite the fact that it's kind of an intrinsically stupid idea. So here's an example of indirect evidence for the mass of something and the direct measurements that backs it up and that really shows you that this sort of approach works. So what do they do? So left one, they go and they measure a bunch of E plus E minus collisions, and then they look at the pattern of data that comes out. And there's a whole bunch of parameters in the Lagrangian. I just talked to you about some of the parameters in the flavor sector, but there's other parameters like the mass of the W, mass of the Z, all sorts of things. And they input all those parameters except for they let the W mass, in this case, float. And then they fit the data, and they find what the W mass should be, just from extracting it without using data that directly measures some sort of resonance that tells you some of the direct information about the W. Okay? So this is an example of indirect extraction of a mass. And that's just a whole bunch of measurements. And they look, they get this value and this value. That's what these two things are. And then we can also make the W directly. We make a lot of them now. This was discovered in the late 80s. But Tevatron and left two goes, and they measure the W mass directly by measuring resonances and things that just form directly with the masses. And it's incredibly consistent, right? I mean, these are one sigma bands. But it's incredibly consistent. It works. This what the takeaway lesson is, indirectly looking for the mass of something in the pattern of data, the electric precision data, and then directly going and finding its mass once you have enough energy to actually make it directly, works. It works really well. You can look at the left lecture week working group if you want to look at more details on what the web page is here. I guess it's too small to see, but it is there. So you can do the same thing with the Higgs mass, the one mass we haven't found directly. And that's what people do. So what this is that you do the same sort of thing. You have all the parameters in the Lagrangian except for the Higgs mass, and you let the Higgs mass float, and everything else is fixed because we've measured everything else directly. Okay, so then you fit the data, and you get a chi-squared fitting the data. It's not zero, but you get a best fit value.
And that's basically the Higgs mass for a 90 GeV. And then...
Is it intrinsic that the indirect measurements give you a lower value than the direct ones? I mean, is there...
No.
Coincidence?
No. It's just, it's not a coincidence. There's nothing to it. Don't take more out of, don't think that this is some sort of generic result at all. There's nothing to that. Are you worried about the distinction between these and this?
Or yeah, the fact that... Like,
well, look, this is one sigma, right? So what's the difference between this and this? That's 1-2 sigma. Statistically, that's nothing. It's not a real discrepancy. There's nothing to it. Okay, so what was I saying? So the Higgs, right? So they do the same thing for the Higgs. So what we do now for the Higgs, because we haven't found it yet directly. You float the Higgs mass parameter. Everything else you fix because you've measured other ways. And you get a chi-squared for that. It's not zero, but it's just some number. And it best fit value is that the Higgs mass is around 90 GeV. And then...
One question. Yeah. Can you say again which processes we are looking at?
E plus E minus going to stuff. And all sorts of like asymmetries of the decay products and direct... Yeah, that's what it is. Just E plus E minus right around the Z pole. Around the energy of the Z. So the mass of the Z.
And that's some resonances and from there...
Yeah, there's decay products. There's asymmetries and decays. There's all sorts of angular information that you can get out of these decays. There's a whole bunch of things. It's like 20 or 30 things. I don't want to go and explain them all, but probably if you want. But yeah, it's like only around 20 or 30 measurements of the different sorts of aspects of the C plus and minus experiments right around that energy. Different things they can measure. So they get a best fit value for the Higgs mass, and then if you start to increase the Higgs mass or decrease the Higgs mass away from that best fit value, this tells you basically how your chi-square gets worse than the chi-square value actually had. And there's some, these different lines here are just because there's a technicality in what goes into this. In part, there's leg by leg two-point functions, which are hard. If they have something in them that's hard to figure out, which is just this uncertainty. It's a contribution of light hadrons to light by light two-point functions. But don't worry about it. The point is that as you go away from that best value of about 90 GeV, it goes up, right? And then they look directly for the Higgs at left two, and they exclude everything here in yellow up to this, which is 114.4 GeV. So you might get scared and say, oh, look, there's tension in the data, right? They've excluded the best fit value. But, you know, this is one sigma gets you around, out here. It's not anything really to worry about yet. And the good money is on the Higgs being about 120 GeV. Okay? So I just told you that if you do the same thing for the W, indirect and then direct, it works. The good money is it's going to work again. We're going to find it pretty soon. Now, I'll get to the point of it's a little hard to see when it's that mass, but we will find it in LHC once we fix it. So the Higgs is very unsatisfying, but it seems to work. I hope I've convinced you that it has non-trivial predictions that have been verified by experiment.
Who's the monkey?
The monkey is a particle physicist, a theorist. Because experimentalists in particle physics are perfectly happy, actually, with the standard model. This is actually a T-search suggestion Bjorn Lange and myself had for TASSI 2002, which is just a theoretical advanced study institute for particle physics theorists. And it's trying to represent to you that this is the intellectual cage of the standard model, right? Once we have a Higgs, we're a pretty happy monkey to fit the data. But we really want all sorts of interesting things here. In particular, monkeys like bananas, right? We want Susie. And in fact, you know, we kind of able to reach out. This we were a little ignorant at the time. I guess we probably should have had the right kind of neutrino. I mean, neutrinos do have mass in there. Well, it's argued how that comes about. But and at the time, I was pretty down on string theory because I didn't understand it at all. So I thought they were nuts. But I've kind of mellowed on that recently. I wouldn't say they're nuts anymore. And dark stuff was kind of a mystery at the time. So it's dark matter. So anyways, the particle physics monkey's cage, really, by the standard model. Because it works. The data works, right? We can just fit the data with the standard model.
What are the strong points or the
I don't know. It was some sort of symmetry breaking thing that was going on at the time. Some other form of electroweak symmetry breaking. Yeah, so it's Ben, electroweak symmetry breaking. Don't take the picture too seriously. Gil, I can't believe we're getting most questions on this picture. It's amazing.
Wasn't
part of this picture.
Wasn't the winning suggestion?
Actually, part of the suggestions was the T-shirt.
Did we win? I think we did win. Okay, I lost my T-shirt, actually, so I don't remember if we won.
I don't remember beyond one.
There was some other lame suggestion where they would just have all of our... It was totally lame and arrogant, which was we just have all of our names in the papers we had done. Whoever saw this recording, I'm sorry, but that's a stupid idea. It was really dumb. So yeah, I think we did win, didn't we?
Yes.
Did you ever see someone walk around with this T-shirt?
I think Bjorn was walking with this T-shirt.
Okay, so we won. Good. Yeah, I think we did, for the number. It was a suggestion, and then we won. Good. That's our only collaboration so far. So anyways, take heart. There's good reasons to think that the Higgs isn't the end of the story, and that we're about to find a whole bunch of interesting stuff, despite the fact that the data can be well described by this kind of model. So new stuff. Now, I'm going to embarrass myself, because I don't know anything really about dark matter. I wrote a paper on it last week, but I really don't know anything about it. But I do know this much, which is that there's good reasons to think that there needs to be dark matter, and that it, and I do know the fact that it cannot be explained by the standard model. So this, I think, is the silver bullet for dark matter. So you can argue about, I'm not going to say too much, but basically it's two galactic clusters going and smashing into one another. The galaxies basically go straight through. The dark matter goes straight through because it's basically collisionless. And what's left behind is most of the baryonic matter is in this hot gas, this X-ray gas. So that's in red here. And optical is all white, and then the dark matter that you get from gravitational lensing is given in blue here. Okay? So this is a way that you can basically scrape away most of the matter that's in a galactic cluster and look to see if there's still the gravitational effect of dark matter. So you can stop arguing about things like Mon. And I think that the conclusion that I'm taking and the particle physics community has taken is that dark matter is real and we have to deal with it. And WMAP tells us there's 5 times more of it than standard ordinary baryonic matter. So the standard model doesn't explain dark matter, so we know there's got to be something outside of that cage, which is good, right? The monkey will be happy for a little while. And the standard model also can explain other things, important things, like our existence, because we're made of baryons. There has to be baryon asymmetry in the universe. And with no higher scale physics, the standard model alone can explain the observed baryon asymmetry of the universe. In fact, built into the standard model is the mechanism of baryogenesis, but it doesn't work because the Higgs mass is too heavy, basically. So we need something else, because we're here. So what else is going on in dark matter now, or in hard physics now? Well, what else is going on? Dark matter speculation. So particle physics is a little bit of a fad field. Something comes along, gets us excited, and people go crazy about it. So what is going on in the field right now in the last couple months is a lot of dark matter speculation. Because you can argue that the dark matter has something to do with the Higgs and electroweak symmetry break. So I resisted putting equations down. I wanted to have the equation minimal. But you can derive, just from astrophysics, that assuming a WIMP paradigm, the typical cross-section of that, the annihilation cross-section of that WIMP will be about a picobarn, which is good because we can see that at LHC. We'll see picobarn cross-sections there. And the typical mass of this WIMP to fit the data that we get out, to fit basically the all this information we have about dark matter, is about 100 GeV to 1 TeV. And that's suspiciously close to electroweak masses, like the Higgs mass. So we could see it, and we should see it at LHC. And in fact, in October, which is this is what I just wrote the paper about last week, they actually came back and the Pamela experiment, which is looking for cosmic rays, and is counting the number of positrons in cosmic rays and electrons in cosmic rays. They actually reported that above what they expected, which is this background curve here, that they count the number of positrons at high energies compared, and they divide it by the number of electrons and positrons, and it's much higher than they expected it to be just due to standard astrophysical secondary production. But don't worry about this. They think they understand that as some sort of solar modulation. But it goes up. And one way it could go up is if you had dark matter around and it was annihilating into, say, E plus E minus pairs. So there's been a lot of speculation on that in the particle physics community recently. And if that happened, then it would push that curve up at high energies. So what else is going on in particle physics? Well, utter agony over the hierarchy problems, what else is going on in particle physics, which has been going on for a long time.
So we have all of these non-trivial tests of the Higgs sector and the consequences of the Higgs telling us that the Higgs is right. It's consistent with the CKM flavor sector, which is, you know, we can pull off other models to do that, but it's not so easy. Electric precision data, it works. Things like the Rho parameter work for like 5 decimal places. So the Higgs probably exists and will be found soon once we fix LHC. But there's a dirty little fact, which if you aren't in the particle physics theory community, you might not know, which is that the Higgs doesn't make any sense alone in quantum field theory. So our whole life is our whole Lagrangian, which is our whole life, really. That's really what it boils down to. It's a Freudian slip, but it's true. Yeah. Our whole Lagrangian is dictated by symmetry, right? You remember that symmetry was so important, gauge symmetry was so important. There's no symmetry in the standard model that makes the Higgs have a mass between 114 GeV and 150 GeV, which is where the electric precision data tells us it probably is. Well, the electric precision data, you remember, was telling us around 90 GeV, but we've excluded up to 114.4 GeV, right? So there's no symmetry that tells us it should be that mass. Well, there's no symmetry that tells us the other masses either, but the Higgs is a kind of a different story. What mass should the Higgs have in the standard model? Well, it's a scalar field, and in fact, it has a quadratic divergence, which is bad news. The Higgs, if you just do the top loop contribution to the Higgs, this just comes from the Yukawa sector. This is the Yukawa coupling of the top to the Higgs. And you calculate this loop, which is a quantum correction to the Higgs mass, you get that it's quadratically divergent, and it goes as the square of the cutoff of the theory, which arguments about the unification of couplings tell us should be maybe 10 to the 15 GeV, which is a very, very big number, and much bigger than basically 100 GeV. It's a discrepancy of 10 to the 13, okay? That's a big problem. I guess you're all used to it, so you're not shocked, but it is a big problem. So, but wait, if you remember quantum field theory from graduate school, which I hope you do, you remember that parameters alone don't make any sense. You have to normalize them, right? Because the party in the vacuum tells you you need to normalize parameters. And everything is divergent. Who cares, right? Until you normalize. So the actual measure it takes mass will be some bare mass parameter plus this part that comes from the standard model plus this quadratic divergence correction. Oh, look at that. I lost a square. I made the hierarchy problem much easier. No. Okay, well, sorry, there's a square in there. So it could be, in principle, it could be that this happens to be, and I actually put in the number of digits that this would have to happen, that this is some number like this. Just happens to be that. And this is some number like that. And it just happens to be that this minus this is what we think it is. Which could be the case, but honestly, if it is, I'm retiring in disgust and becoming a hermit, because it's just offensive. We have good reasons to think this is not the case. Now, there are extremely smart particle physicists that are actually willing to consider this to be the case. And it may be the case, but a lot of us think that new physics has to come in and fix this problem. And history gives us hope, right? Here's another little historical aside. We had a very similar problem in the past. Now, this is wiki knowledge, so it's a little dangerous. I just Googled hierarchy problem and looked at Wikipedia, and I got reminded of this. So I think it's right. But the classical electron self-energy was infinite, right, as the radius of the electron goes to zero. If you just calculate it classically, there's the shell, right, and there's the energy, it's Coulomb's law, integrate from RE to infinity, and you get this answer. And if you actually then set, well, we know it's not infinite because we measure it, it's 0.5 MeV. So if you then figure out the radius at which that corresponds to 0.5 MeV, put in the numbers, you get our friend the fine structure constant, basically, and then that's just the quantum wavelength of the electron. So this was a divergence that made people worry a lot. And the positron actually comes in at the quantum wavelength. Remember, quantum field theory came in once you reach the quantum wavelength of the electron. You have positrons. It came in to fix the problem at exactly the scale we knew it needed to come in. But before the positron, some very smart guys, were thinking that fine-tuning was the answer for that, too. They were building models, apparently, where they're giving the shell of the electron a negative mass, and then everything interior was a positive mass, so you could take this limit as the radius of the electron goes to zero in a sensible way and fix the problem with spooky cancellation. So it's not like people haven't thought of fine-tuning before, but it was wrong there, and we think it's wrong here. So how can new physics fix this? Well, that's when people disagree. But particle physicists spend lots of time building models to fix this. And what you really need to do, if it's a good model, is you need to forbid that mass term by symmetry. Because the only way to get it so that loop corrections are not going to screw things up is to have a symmetry reason that that mass term is zero. So the good models have a symmetry forbidding this mass term. So what do people do? Well, they use a shift symmetry. This H goes to AH or something. And that just leads you to pseudo-Goldstone-Higgs models, which I've worked on a little bit. Or you can relate the Higgs to a gauge field, put it as a component in some higher dimensional gauge field, and then you can use gauge symmetry to forbid that gauge field to have a mass. That happens in a lot of extra dimension models. You can relate the Higgs to a fermion and use chiral symmetry, then to forbid its mass. That's what SUSY does. So, or you could just lower the cutoff scale. That M was really the scale which the thing broke down, the three broke down, which we argue with coupling constant unification is 10 to the 15 GeV. But if you lower that down, then you could have a theory which doesn't have spooky cancellations and strong electric symmetry breaking techni theories, which are having a little resurgence recently, do that. And some extra dimension models could do that as well. So you need some way to fix the problem. And a lot of the resources of the particle theory community is devoted to fixing these problems. So, but you know, when it comes right down to it, SUSY is by far the prettiest way to get it done. It's beautiful. I don't want to go into the math again, but it's elegant. And particle physics is full of people that are actually literally convinced reality is supersymmetric. They are convinced. They're absolutely convinced. They're almost like religious fanatics. It's really kind of amazing. And if you poke them, boy, do they get angry. But it's true. They really think this. Because it's beautiful. It really is. They're probably right, actually. But, well, at some energy scale, they're probably right. I mean, really, they are. So the way it fixes the problem is really elegant, and it really, you know, there's reasons they think this. It seems like this quantum wavelength problem leading to the positron, right? For every standard model particle, there's a superpartner, which is degenerate in mass, but different by spin 1/2. And the loops just cancel. So you had this horrible loop. You have something called a stop, which just comes in, cancels that loop off. This is a beautiful solution, and it's probably right. But it might not be right. And really, the only reason we believe in the Higgs, despite its nature, is that it explains the data, right? What does data say about SUSY? Well, people will not agree about this. So I'm going to give you one opinion. And one opinion is that it does have some problems with data. So it was believed by many, and they probably would deny this now, but it was believed by many that it should affect flavor physics. It should affect the CKM. And so here's the reason why. Not necessarily the CKM, but how it should affect flavor physics. We've been looking for it in flavor changing neutral currents because its direct existence in reality has not been verified yet. And we've been looking very, very hard for it. So here's something that it should affect. This is a one loop process in the standard model that E quark comes along and the W, there's a U, T, or C here. Because the top quark is heavy, the Jim suppression is not that big. It spits off a photon, and then the W and the remaining quark go back into an S quark. This is something that SUSY should also affect at one loop, right? If you just take these guys and make them S particles. And what does data say? Well, data says the branching ratio for this B meson. This B is not just a free B, it's built into a B meson, obviously. And the branching ratio, it's relative decay into anything with an S quark plus a photon, which is an inclusive decay. So you can handle the QCD. That hadronic muck doesn't cause too much trouble. It's found to be this value experimentally. And the standard model with no SUSY, people calculate this. And this is a very serious calculation. This was, I think this Misiak is the guy that did the most recent work on this. Doing 20,000 loops to fourth order, okay? This is serious stuff. And this thing is built into a meson, right? So this is very impressive stuff. And it agrees up to like one sigma. So there's a lot of people that thought that we would find SUSY this way, and we didn't. Now that isn't necessarily a problem, because SUSY has enough parameter space that you can build SUSY models to avoid this problem. It can be done. Absolutely can be done. Well, what is it? Is it? This is the standard model. This is the theory calculation. This is the measurement, right? Yeah, but that's when you vary those parameters, that's how you get the theoretical error. Right? I think that'll be built in, right? That'll be in this error. Yeah, absolutely. Well, if this gives you hope, what is it? It's like two sigma? Yeah. It's like one sigma. Sorry?
It's like a sigma.
You said it was.
I think it's more than minus 0.4 compared to 0.2.
Look, is it more than 2?
No, it's not.
Okay, 2 isn't real. 2 isn't a real discrepancy either, so don't worry about it. Right? Well, I guess worry about it if you want, but I think people take this as this should not work nearly as well as it should if there was something coming in at one loop and competing with this, right? There's no doubt about that. So the options are to build SUSY models avoiding this problem, which is what lots of people do, and that's fine, because there's lots of parameter space and SUSY is probably right. Or you think about alternative models, then have SUSY at a higher scale. So physicists fight about this, particle physicists fight about this, but on balance, people believe in SUSY. It's just testament. And other models compete with it, but it's the 800-pound gorilla. And the fight will end soon, because data in the form of LHC is coming, and it should just answer the questions. So I promised you this LHC wow moment. Did I promise you that at the start? So I think I did. So usually people start talks with the pictures of LHC, which are just, it's an amazing thing. It's a miraculous thing. And it is, and we're going to get to that now. So you remember that Prokhorov guy, the guy who was smashing things into lithium that got the Nobel Prize? He went on to found a little place called CERN, a bunch of his friends. And they have the newest, biggest, most fancy, amazing particle physics collider ever. That's going to start working there soon. It's a proton-proton collider, which is kind of nice, because we started with proton smashing into lithium. And they move it 0.9999999c. That's really what they move at. And it's 27 kilometers in circumference. Remember, we started with 7 meters. It's 14 TeV, so we've increased the energy by a factor of 9. It's at least $3 billion. That went up a lot more, too, compared to this thing they built on their tabletop. But it's the largest experiment ever in size. There's about 6,000 physicists working on it. It's 300 feet down and 16 miles to perfect mechanics. It's just awesome. So it's magnificent. So if you look down, it's this huge ring that's underneath the grid. This is, I think, SPS. And it crosses the Swiss-French border. And this is what particle physics is going to be all about in the near future, to a large degree. So if you just scrape away the land, they're going to accelerate protons around in this guy and smash them together into CMS and ATLAS, and there's also LHCb ATLAS. But CMS and ATLAS, I think, are where the most exciting information about electric physics is going to come from. And that's actually a picture. That's a person part. And I think this is the same room. Is this the CMS chamber or the Atlas chamber?
That's Atlas.
Is this Atlas?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's before they put in the experiment. Just look at this. This is like, it's amazing. It's magnificent. And it's such a big thing, you can barely see how this thing curves, right? And so it's a proton-proton collider, but because of particle distribution functions, the proton's made up of quarks and gluons. But the PDF for the gluons are such that basically it's a gluon-gluon collider, which is going to make a lot of pixels. So what's going to happen is these gluons are going to come along, it's going to be a top quark loop, and it's going to produce a Higgs. All right, so that's how we think we're going to make the Higgs, because we think its mass is around 120 GeV. But how are we going to detect it? Well, that's a different story. So the branching ratios of the Higgs and standard model are going to be here. This just tells you if you have a Higgs, what does it decay into? For light Higgs, this line here is the smart one, about 120 GeV. It decays mostly into BBs, and then there's WW here, and then there's tau tau, CC, blah, 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 blah. If you go up to 140 GeV, it gets much easier to see, because then if it decays into two Ws, those Ws can decay into leptons, and that's what some people call the golden channel. You'll be able to see that for sure. But we think that it's probably around 120 GeV. So it's actually going to be a little harder to see than you might think. Well, we just look at the decay products of BB, right? Well, it's not quite that simple. See this down here, this photon-photon branching ratio? We're going to actually have to use that, which is quite surprising. Why is that?
So obviously the process where you have a gluon created through some process splitting into d quarks is much, much bigger. The total cross-section of d quark production is way up here. And yet, when you want to have the Higgs decaying into BB and measuring this, this is just going to be a small process. It's loops press. And it's also just true that this is just a much smaller process. You're about 6 orders of magnitude or something lower d quark production. And you also have to multiply by the branching ratio. This is a log plot, but nonetheless, it's not good. So HDBB is the biggest decay, but we're not going to be able to see that directly for light cases. So what are we going to do? Our hopes rest on this diagram for light cases. Two gluons come in, top quark triangle diagram produce the Higgs, another top quark triangle diagram, and then two photons. This is what CMS simulated the signal. This is what it should look like. In a calorimeter, there should be two well-collimated deposits of energy. This actually serves as CMS's here. And this should be how we discover the Higgs. It should, and if it's this light of Higgs, it'll take more data than it would be with the W. It's probably around 10 femtomarks of Higgs. And this could be how we discover the origin of mass. And that's what it's all about at this point at LHC physics. And so stay tuned, and we'll know. I think that's it.
Non-particle physicists.
Non-experts. Of particle physicists, don't ask me.
Are there any questions from the comments?
We just want to heckle me, probably.
General questions. Particle physics.
Any questions?
Why?
The origin of mass is clear.
Why is it called for the for the long one?
Because it's most massive, and so it has the strongest Yukawa coupling to the Higgs. That's the reason.
So there's, suppose parallel data is because of dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
The models that explain parallel data will have some parameters, and you have to fit the parameters to explain the data, etc. Are those parameter values consistent with what should be observable at LHC?
Well, you actually increase the annihilation cross section. If you have a standard beam by the factor of 100, and you can see it. And it should make it even easier to see it. Yeah, we should see it. I mean, but is it numerology or not? It's purely from astrophysics you get this cross-section out and you get this mass out, which is really an amazing thing. And yeah, so I think that the smart money is also on that we will see some form of dark matter at LHC. And if they fit in the Pamela data, yes, we would believe we would see it. Well, it depends on the decay products, because LHC is a very dirty environment. Right, so if it decayed in some way that was just pathological and was hiding in backgrounds, which is a major concern, then we won't necessarily, it'll be created, but we won't necessarily be able to conclude it's there. But I don't know of any, does anyone know any serious neutralino studies at LHC or often see them?
I think Maxime can make you a model where he wants to do it.
Well, Maxime can make models of anything, but seriously, just standard sort of neutralino dark matter, is it kind of a guarantee?
I don't know. I don't think it is, but I don't know.
This is going to be parameter space where it can hide. Basically, that's kind of a general rule. But cross section is big enough; it'll be produced.
So we've got two groups of people around PI who spend all of their time thinking about gravitational issues.
They're after the theory of everything.
Mm-hmm. Pardon?
They want that theory of everything.
Yeah. So within the scope of particle physics, do you guys spend any time thinking about that last force that doesn't fit into the standard model?
Is it sure? Lots of people do. I don't, but I mean, I haven't yet, but lots of people do. Yeah. I don't want to say anything about it because it's going to get me in trouble.
I'm just curious how it comes in. I know a little bit about what the quantum gravity and string theory people think about. I'm curious what particle physicists think about when they think about gravity.
That's just going to get me in trouble. I'll give you an honest answer privately.
Maybe I can ask this since it's not. In terms of the scale, we talked about the Planck scale. I mean, right now we're going to get into the PME range. If you talk about extra dimension theories, they give you, allow you to see effects of, if you want, from gravity at the LHC level, then yes, this is interesting for the problems. But in terms of, unless you're
there are ways to solve
the higher communicating to the stuff you're going to see at the LAT, then you know, it's, we're not there yet.
So, look, if you solve the hierarchy problem in certain ways, which involve extra dimensions, then you can argue that we could see effects that has to do with gravity at LHC. But yeah, anything I say was going to be true.
So maybe large extra dimensions is the point where the fields.
That's one point where the fields converge, yeah.
Okay, so I think we'll move on to the slide again. Our next speaker is Ethan Thompson.